From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. We have a special live edition of the show for you today, recorded at the LA County Museum of Arts, where writer-director David O. Russell joined me for a discussion after a screening of his newest film, American Hustle.
So many of your movies are kind of about tribes going up against each other.
Mm, yes.
Almost like warring families or clans. Mm. Where does that come from for you?
I don't know. There's something very elemental about it, I think, that started really for me with The Fighter. I happened to write...
But you could even say it was the case with Flirting with Disaster as well. I mean, even in that case, there's like these sort of tribes. I mean, it goes back to that, I think, even.
True. I don't know, maybe it's just how my family's wired, you know? I mean, I have a huge family that's scattered over the five boroughs and all of the New York area. But see, for me, after Three Kings, which is when I met you at that time, when you were at the New York Times, I feel like after that period, I kind of had a period that was very difficult for me for a lot of reasons. I mean, part of it was that I was helping my son, who has bipolar issues, find a better school and everything, which became a massive undertaking with my ex-wife. We got divorced. I lost my way as a storyteller a little bit, and that became a very difficult period for me. And the reason I talk about it is because that difficulty kind of turned out to be the best thing that could have happened to me, I mean, as a filmmaker, because it kind of humbled me, and it led me to, when Sidney Pollack gave me Silver Linings Playbook, which I took as a writer for hire, it was a very personal chance for me to write about my own family, which would have factions about how to handle that situation, about the bipolar kid. And I related very personally to that, but it was more very much from the gut, or as Irving would say, from the feet up. You know, it was very deep and instinctive and kind of pure. And then I couldn't make it. I couldn't get it made. My stock was low, frankly. You know, I couldn't get a movie easily made.
Even after The Fighter?
No, this was, I wrote it before The Fighter. And then I got to make The Fighter, thanks to my, you know, Mark Wahlberg, my friend, who gave me a great opportunity and believed in me. And Silver Linings and The Fighter kind of talked to each other, because I was rewriting Silver Linings, and as I was writing The Fighter, helping to rewrite it, even though I was uncredited, and creating very powerhouse women's roles, which became the secret to me. Powerhouse women's roles was a great, yeah, that's it. I mean, many things became very clear. I have very strong women in my family. Suddenly, it was so clear to me, you know, that these were the people, and I think all my life and all my filmmaking was really leading to this period. You know, I'm a late bloomer. I thank God it happened, you know, before I died. But things became very, because it can happen, where you're doing good films, you know, but you haven't really gone down the way you're meant to go, you know, deep, the way you can do, from the music of your own heart. And to my shock, to see the things that were revealed to me as to who I am and what I love as a filmmaker, including romance, you know, which started in The Fighter and then continued into Silver Linings. I happen to love it. And
also about people fighting for romance, too. I mean, there's a real fight for love in these movies, isn't there?
Yes.
When you came to my show to talk about The Fighter, I told you that was a line of demarcation for me, because the movies went from being kind of about abstract, figurative things to real emotion. There was a line that happened there too, was certainly about feeling and people talking about feelings and fighting for these things. And that was also, was being humble something that put you in touch with emotion in a way you hadn't been before?
Very much so. I think it got me out of my head. You know, I don't think anything is a cliche when you really do it, you know, from the heart. And when you know people who have been through it themselves, you know, or you've been through it yourself, you know, romance or heartbreak or any of these stories are not a cliche. I would have looked at The Fighter or Silver Linings and said, I don't know, I would have overthought them. As it was, The Fighter, I don't think of these films as categorization or categorizable. They're all about the emotions and the people to me. That's the whole thing to me. Or as Sinatra would say, that's the whole trick of the record. You know, that's the whole thing to me. And that's why I'm there. And that's what's endlessly fascinating to me and exhilarating to me. You know, there's like an aliveness in that that I find, and I want to feel exhilarated when I leave a movie. I mean, when they, no matter the heartbreak or the passion that's in it, the aliveness, you know, when the Duke Ellington record, which Amy Adams says, you know, saved her life many times, that is a Duke Ellington record that I love. And music and cinema have saved my life many times. They're better than any pill that's on the market. as far as I'm concerned, and they can change your day or your week. And I always have to have a classic movie that I'm looking at every day, some part of it, just 20 minutes of it. And it's like having a song in your head.
Was there a movie you saw today or a piece of music just that you came across on this very day?
Today I've been watching African Queen, which I hadn't seen in a long time, which is an extraordinary movie. I mean, John Huston's African Queen. It's kind of a perfect movie. I could spend the next hours talking about it. But I mean, because it's like these two people on a raft, and they go through virtually everything a human can go through on that raft together. And it's also very romantic in the end. It's very enchanting.
And it's interesting, too, because that's, I mean, the other line for me between these movies, and we've talked about this before, is those early movies felt like they were made by a much younger man.
For sure.
And it seems almost like you free yourself up to be in touch with feeling, which I find to be an extraordinary thing, because that's not something to see somebody change in midstream like that is, I think, an extraordinary thing for a creative person to do.
I don't know. The only way I know how to answer that is I've probably always been 10 years, emotionally 10 years younger than my actual age. I'm probably famous for that. But it's served me in some ways, but I had to catch up to the rest of the... I don't know what else to say.
No, because I just think to go from making movies about ideas...
Yeah, no, I'd rather make it about, you know, the fabric of the people. Their world is as compelling to me as the story. So who they are in their house, their bathroom, their kitchen, their bedroom, what they're listening to, what they're eating, the piccata that Carmine Polito and Dolly Polito say, it's the piccata of the gods. They're so excited about the piccata in the restaurant. I've been there when people are like, you gotta have this, you know? And it's like, because it's something that they, you know, they really, that's what part of what puts their feet on the floor every day. You know, it's like that special stuff. So I love all that emotion. And Christian Bale, to go to what you're saying about emotion, I would say all these movies are operatic in some way. And so Christian, you know, we were talking about this, and he rightly observed that I think everybody has an opera of emotions going on inside themselves. They may not express it that way. The members of my family happen to. But they may not express it that way. But you go to sleep and you have a surreal opera that happens every night of your greatest dreams, desires, angers, hopes, fears, that crazy. And you wake up and it goes away. And he said that being an actor is like a waking dream where they get to live that craziness and that emotion as a person. And so that's what our set is. It feels like everybody's gone to an altered state. Jennifer describes it as a high. I was reading something where I'm always reading these old interviews. And I was reading this old interview with Paul McCartney from the early 70s, and he had happened to meet Dustin Hoffman. And Dustin Hoffman said, I wish I could write a song like you. And Paul McCartney said, but what you do is very similar to what I do. You pull it out of the bag, don't you, man? You just do it. You don't know where it came from. You know, and that's the magic that I think Duke Ellington would call beyond category, you know, what he called his music. And that's what I'm trying to do with these actors, and they're doing. So they're going to that place where they're pulling it out of the bag. You know, when you're sitting there in a scene with Bradley or Christian or Amy or Jennifer, you know that something's going to happen. And my job is to take them to the precipice of that by creating that role in the first place that gives them, and you need a doozy of a predicament. Each of these films has a doozy of a predicament, whether it's The Fighter or Silver Linings and now American Hustle. It's that predicament that will allow you to then go rich with every character. Amy Adams, from the most raw I've ever seen her to the most glamorous and beautiful, you know, and everything in between. That was the intention. And I know that when I look at her or Jennifer on a set and there's a moment where you go, okay, there's something kind of like now, like they're going to go to fifth gear now and they're going to pull something out of the bag and it's going to be really intense and we don't really even know what it is. They don't even know what it is.
As you say that, I can't help but think about the scene where Jennifer just kisses Amy. Mm. I mean, that's one of the greatest moments I've seen in the movie, just for Amy's take and that smeared lipstick on her face. Where did that scene come from?
We knew these two women were very powerful and smart in different ways, and we knew that they had a very electric thing between them that they was could be hatred, but it could also be a weird attraction. They're sleeping with the same man. And it actually was Amy's idea that just came to her. Sometimes ideas come and they're from instinct and you don't know why or how, but you have to trust them. And it just felt really amazing to me, but we weren't sure how to make it happen, and we told Jennifer about it. She wasn't sure either, but we didn't think we were going to do it. We said, okay, we can't figure it out. We're not going to do it. And then on the moment, on the day, Jennifer said, you know, what if I kissed her? Because it's my goodbye to her. It's like my farewell, you know, and it made sense in that way. It made a toxic Rosalind Rosenfeld sense, you know, this Picasso of passive aggressive karate. You know, that would be her coup de grace. But what really makes it work is that she falls apart immediately.
That scene afterwards, she with
Jack Houston,
yeah, when she just completely disintegrates. I mean, it's just she used all her karate and she's spent.
Yes, exactly. She's very vulnerable, and it was a front. You know, and it's as we all must do. That's what interested Christian Bale and I when we first were in his backyard talking about the picture. It's not the historical events per se, because I told the writers and the producer that I would like to rewrite it as I had done the last two films, you know, as about these people, with their permission. And Eric Singer had written a beautiful script, but I had to do it not about events or procedures, about the people instead. And Christian and I were intrigued not by the idea of a mere sociopath or a criminal or a grifter. That we were interested in someone who's a human being with a beating heart, who loves people in his life, he loves the women, loves his child, loves his craft, and as anybody, how he's like everybody. You have to embrace an identity and a passion in life, and sometimes you lose that, or you have to redo it. It's like a do-over. My marriage fell apart. My job fell apart. I don't like how I look. I don't know who I am. That's what we were after. So when he's doing his hair for us, it's like his soul. It's not his hair. And it's like, his meticulousness is an art. He thought of his character as a theater director or as a film director, as an artist. And that Richie was a very eager student. And Edith was the student who had surpassed him in this art. And that was a term he took from Bob Hoskins, from the feet up, that Bob Hoskins had said to him, acting's not from the ears up, it's from the feet up.
It's funny you say it, because as I was watching this, I kind of found myself thinking of Bob Hoskins in Along Good Friday a little bit.
Oh,
you know what I mean? I mean, that kind of thing where he has to take over a room, and when he's in the room, we're not sure what's going on. You know what I mean? I mean, that kind of power he brings to this.
Yes. It happens to everybody every day. You know, it can be at home or it can be at work. You know, how are you going to be part of a room or run a room?
Well, I just found what's interesting, too, about the second half of your career is that as the movies are unfolding, we're not aware of plot. I mean, it seems to be happening in the moment very much so much so, and in such grand operatic terms that I think as audiences, we're lost in the moment. Is that important for you as a filmmaker, too, to sort of make that feel like it's completely happening intensely and we get lost in that?
Completely. That's the wish, is to completely immerse us in a moment that's so deep in itself that you don't exactly know what's going to happen next, and you're almost having to catch up with the picture.
Because that's a really novel way to deal with this, because again, just going back to that first half, we were kind of aware where we were being taken, and you got pleasure in sort of like laying out that track for us to follow, and that doesn't happen in these last three films at all. With The Fighter and Silver Linings and this, I mean, that's the other division to me,
right,
that the moments are so rife, in fact, that again,
you get lost in them a little bit.
That's
absolutely, I would say that's what I love in my favorite cinema. You know what I'm saying? I mean, is you get lost in something. It's so intense that it kind of overwhelms you in a way with whatever it is. And then as you're sort of waking up from that, it's plunging you into the next moment. And then I like it that at the end of the movie, it was so bracing and exhilarating and alive. You may have to go back and watch it again because you have to kind of watch how it was put together, or you have to try to see what happened.
It's The Treatment, a live edition of the show with David O. Russell from the LA County Museum of Arts. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
Welcome back for more of the discussion with David O. Russell at the LA County Museum of Arts. He's talking about his newest film as writer-director, American Hustle. It's The Treatment.
Well, what's interesting too, these last two movies really feel to me almost like musicals, because there's so much music in both of them, and dance is so important in both of them too. It also felt like you were a bit making a Minnelli movie in some way.
The movies are becoming more musical, and I feel like I'm backing my way into making a musical. I don't know, you know, Silver Linings was so musical. If you'd ever said to me you're going to make a movie about dance and a dance content, I would say you're high. You know, that's not gonna happen. And even when we were doing it, I was like, are we crazy? Is this gonna be insane when it happens? You come to embrace it. There's an enchantment in it. And so that then things come to you while you're making the film. The idea of Jennifer and what they call in England, the marigolds. Are there any British people here? Aren't they called marigolds? I was just told that in England. That's what they call those yellow cleaning gloves. That's a brand. I thought it was because they look like yellow marigolds. But apparently they can also be pink, because there are also pink marigolds, right? Yes. No blue. Are there blue marigolds? No. Purple.
This is very educational for all of us now.
So, you know, that I said, Jennifer, you're going to sing Live and Let Die. I'm so excited. You know, this song is like a cinematic song in itself. I haven't seen it since I watched that movie when I was like 12 years old in the movie theater, you know, with Live and Let Die. And it's a very operatic song that changes a lot. But the theme is so good. But instinctively, again, like the kiss, I didn't know where it would go. And you have to leave room in the schedule, even though the ADs and the producers are not sure you have left room in the schedule. And they're saying, how are we going to do that? And Jennifer literally gets a half an hour to do it. You know, so she had to memorize two songs, because they said, what if we can't get the rights to Live and Let Die?
The other song.
I said, well, you also always need leverage, because if you only license one song, then they've got you over the coals, don't they? Yes, you can have our song for $5 million. So the other song was Evil Ways, which she did very beautifully as well. You've got to change your evil ways.
Oh, the Santana.
The Santana song. I come home, my pots are cold and my house is dark. Yeah, so anyway, she killed them both and threw her neck out doing it. And
is that what she's wearing, the brace at the end?
No, that was actually because her character had moments that were really dark that involved things that we decided we were not going to do. But so that, and I just loved seeing her in the neck brace. When she was preparing last year for the Golden Globes, we were doing like a camera test for this movie, and I remember strapping it on here, and I just was like in heaven, you know, and I just knew it had to be in the movie somehow. You know, I didn't know. I just thought, this is something I love about this. And, you know, the women always having their hair up, which is like my mother's world, you know, just a different world. You know, I like that, with their women with their hair up. Anyway, so then it turns out to be the proper declaration of independence for Rosalind, a toxic declaration of independence. I'm going to let something die to let something live. And then it was a great editing room discovery to intercut that scene in the mob car where Irving's being choked by his ascot and you know, all that stuff, with him describing it to Rosalind. They put a canvas bag over my head. And you cut to then it coming down. And just watching those two go at it was a wonderful energy to see those two actors.
These two movies all feel like they're environments that are homey in a way. You know, even the places that are kind of extravagant feel like they're places that were chosen by a person.
Yes.
And that's got to be key to you too. Again, these movies all have that kind of feel of, I don't want to say documentary because that cheapens it, but it all feels like life is being lived on the screen in front of us, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I would say my favorite sequences in cinema, many of them are like that. Even the sequence in It's a Wonderful Life, where George Bailey loses it on his family, that's almost like a verite scene. And it was so intense for 1946, people almost couldn't handle seeing
it. That's why it was a failure. That's why the movie flopped.
Yes, it was.
And I just wonder, too, if in making a movie like this, if you were worried about that, because it is so intense. I mean, it plays both comedy and melodrama at the same time, which is why I thought of Minnelli, because the great Minnelli movies I think about, like Some Came Running, have that same kind of feel as well, was doing both in the same scene. And I just wonder, because this has become something that, from Silver Lining Playbook to now to this, it feels like it's become a kind of a thing that you like to do, having that weird precarious balance where we don't know whether to laugh or cry or whatever. And I wonder where that impulse comes from for you.
I think it's just on my hard drive, you know, from my family. You know, they're very...
These movies are all autobiographical in some way.
Well, yeah, they're from the way that you feel people are, you know, like the way I feel people are. My family became my greatest resource in a way of characters. And many of them are in the picture. My cousin Richie, who is the one who smashes into the table with De Niro and says, you know, this is way too serious for a party. What are you drinking? You need a drink. I mean, he is that guy, not the guy who's going to smash. Apologies, Richie. You're not the guy who's going to smash into the table, although he does know how to knock back a few. He's a big guy who works at the airports, as many in the family do. He's a regular guy. He's a fantastic human being. And when he introduces Carmine, that's like a real guy from a Carpenters Union or a Teamsters Union introducing Carmine. You know, so I don't know. That's a music that's in you. And you then have a homing device for it. I think my family, and it's from how committed they are to who they're being in this operatic way. So that can be, that's just really, we're going to drill down and commit to that. We're not going to try to be funny. We're not going to try to be dramatic. We're going to be intense and we're going to be real. And that's either going to be funny or dramatic according to what happens.
You like the idea of surprising yourself in these movies too, don't you? I mean, you like the idea of constant surprise because that's another element that unites this sort of second half of your career, these continual unexpected things.
I want things to escalate in a way that's unexpected, which is not easy. And I did like the escalating danger, which did happen in real life. You know, the FBI got involved in this thing and it just got crazier and crazier. It kind of blew sideways. You know,
and a lot of that stuff turned up on TV where you would see, they would show some of these app scam things on video and you go, somebody believes that? I mean, because it's so weird looking as you're watching the videotape.
Yeah, no, it's all crazy. And the thing to me is it was a much more innocent time. To me, the 70s were a kind of time of a certain formality. I don't think of them as grimy. I think of them as, you know, my parents were middle class and they had a formality about them. My dad was a salesman, my mom was a secretary, but they had an elegance about them and their friends did. So they dressed in a way and that's how I think of it. There's a more romantic time. And indeed, $75,000 in a briefcase is innocent compared to today where, you know, the Supreme Court made it legal and hundreds of millions of dollars, billions finance our elections. I don't know who's paying for that. It's not me or anybody I know. And I don't know what they're getting for that either, by the way. So it's, I mean, Richie pierces the veil momentarily from a good intention from his mother's kitchen. I'm going to go do good for us, you know. And I wanted to see his mother, Bradley Cooper, who, you know, started chewing his tongue like a relative has had, and it changed his whole. Just looks like weird and different, you know, and his shoulders hunched up. He so loved the rhythm of this guy. He went home to his girlfriend one night as this guy, which is a fantastic story. Maybe you can get him to tell it sometime. Maybe he'll be mad that I told that. But
how do you choose the songs? Because there's so many songs in this.
Well, you have many of them when you write, and you have
and
you have many of them that are from your heart. And many of them you play on the set so the actors can feel the looseness. I don't want it to feel like a movie set. We have a huddle in the van every morning, not on the set, because I say, this is the movie right here. This, you, me, the breath you feel right now, this is it. Not out there with the lights and everything. It's this intimacy, because you're asking them to be very vulnerable and very intimate in a place with chaos, with grips and lights and trucks and schedules and shouting and all this stuff. So I want them to remember that that's the, and I want to tell them how the day is going to go. And I'll play the music for them. This is the song, I've Got Your Number, that's their love song, that Jack Jones recorded for us himself in the picture. And I love that when we hit them, they're singing it in sync with the song. To go back to your musical idea, that's another musical number in it. Or to have Irving singing with Carmine, the two guys singing Delilah, you know, together with all their hearts. Those are just wonderful moments.
I think what's the thing that probably unites most of the movies you've done, though, is that there's a sense of vanity that you like making fun of. Some of these characters that you've written are incredibly vain people. And just, I was thinking about Bradley in this, or to some extent, the way he's trying to get his weight down in Silver Linings Playbook, or Clooney a little bit in Three Kings, or Ben in Flirting with Disaster. There's something kind of presentational about these people. They want to be seen in a certain way. When people don't see them that way, they don't know what to make of it.
I don't know what to make of that question. Whenever you reach back across the divide to the earlier movies, I kind of get lost. Yeah, a little
Why?
Bit. I don't know. Because I know my way from the last three movies, and that's like a galaxy far, far away.
And can you not look at those movies anymore?
I can absolutely look at them, and I think they're good, and I think they're, you know, filled with inspired stuff. I just don't. It's when you're doing these kind of things, you're in the rhythm of these kind of things. I don't know what you mean by vanity, because when you first said it, I would say, who isn't? In the sense that, who doesn't? You have a certain way you dress. You have a certain way you wear your hair. You changed it since I know you. Didn't you? I mean, it certainly changed color a little bit, did it? No, did it? No, it did, right? No, that's a choice. That's a choice.
It's going whiter right now, as a matter of fact.
You could dye your hair. You could not dye your hair. So those are all choices that people make that I think are interesting.
Yeah, but I think these guys, there's this investment in the way they look, though. Let's just look at Bradley in this, and also Christian's character.
Every character in the movie is conscious of how they want to be, and they had wardrobe that preceded who they were and now who they want to be, and there's aspirational wardrobe. And Amy's character actually did work at Cosmopolitan in real life. That's how she dresses like that.
She's just like a Cosmo cover girl.
Yes,
those
which has a lot of confidence and a lot of enchantment that she believes in, and is also can be very allow you to have a certain power in a room.
Talk about getting Christian to sort of make himself into that guy who's, as we would say, not Batman. I mean, this guy who's very different and is not afraid to show that. I mean, because he often plays these guys who are incredibly sort of like armored and keep people at a distance. And here, he's always sort of opening himself up to people.
He's Fat Man. I love the fact that Christian and I do the roles together that, for him, are vulnerable, goofy, sweet, kind of lovey, kind of fractured, kind of pathetic, all those things. That's what we like to create, and I think he gets off on that.
And also, between this and the fire, these guys who can't stop talking, which I find to be, because he's often playing these guys who, again, are really kind of wary.
Yeah, he could do a silent movie, a very guarded character. Jeremy Renner as well, said, my God, David, this character is the opposite of who I am. I mean, he tends to be a more closed person, and this character wears his heart on his sleeve and is the most warm, embracing character. And it was fun to see him be that and have that come out of him. That's the rhythm of the movie, and that was what Christian embraced. That's what we were aspiring for in creating something beyond category, was to create these characters with an intensity and a kind of magic that you hope you reach in some way.
I think it's the thing they've all got in common in this movie. Even people like Irv, who are keeping secrets to themselves, still lead with their hearts every time they talk. I mean, we know what they're feeling, even if we don't know what they're thinking.
And one of my favorite moments, which was unexpected, is when Bradley Cooper's character apologizes to Amy and to Christian in the hallway of the Plaza Hotel after she smashed him over the head. And he goes, I'm sorry. He said, I'm more sorry. And he looks at Irving. He goes, Irv, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And Christian goes, he tries twice and he can't think of anything to say. He has nothing to say to this man. And that was just a wonderful thing that happened. That's, again, he's expressing his inner emotions. Also, he's a guy who has a great poker face when he needs to in the movie. But I love watching him watch De Niro, or watching him watch his wife go out of control, or trying to control things. Watching him have to decide that he's not going to fight his wife, that he's going to win by letting her win. I mean, that is a wonderful moment to watch the look go across his face of, I'm going to kill her, or, okay, no, I have to agree with her, and then everything's going to be okay.
I'd say I was really, really moved by the scenes he has with his son. I mean, those are really powerful pieces. I mean, when he is with his kid, I mean, that's, we almost sort of get to see the most unguarded version of him.
He's a very sweet father. He's a very natural father. And, our kids have played together. And so, he just took to that very naturally with that kid, And the fact that the real guy did have a big heart for his kid, helps. You want to know that he's a human being.
Let's thank David O. Russell for being here.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special live edition of The Treatment recorded at the LA County Museum of Arts with writer-director David O. Russell about his film, American Hustle. The show was mixed by Melissa Morton. It was edited, recorded, and produced by Jenny Radelet, who does way too much. Special thanks to Film Independent. I'm just Elvis Mitchell. This is The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.